call is now being recorded.
Okay, so this is Jeff Petty, principal of Highline School, and that's a charter school, one of the big picture schools. And Jeff, maybe you could just give me a broad overview of the school and how it started.
So just a couple of corrections to that. I started the school. It's called Highline Big Picture High School, or actually Highline Big Picture Schools. It's a 712 now. It's not a charter. It's just a public school in the district that's just south of Seattle.
Okay. I thought it was a charter.
No, Washington has no charter schools yet. We just passed the law, and the first applications ever are due this November, and then the earliest a charter school open here is fall of 2014. So,
if you can do all the things that you're doing with your school, and it is just a regular public school, why do you need charters?
Oh, that was able to start because of kind of a unique convergence of events, and it's pretty difficult. I guess another way to put it, other than saying it's difficult, there's not really a mechanism for starting schools here prior to the charter laws passing. So if a new school started, it was the result of a district initiating that process or some pretty rare combination of events. And that was the case with how our school started. I had been working at another school in another district that had partnered with Big Picture Learning. And tried to convert what was a pretty low expectation alternative school where students liked to be, and the adults there were definitely super caring, but the outcomes were not anything to be excited about, not a very rigorous place. They partnered with Big Picture Learning in 2001 or two or so in the early work that the Gates Foundation was doing with high schools, tried to convert their school to a Big Picture school. That was going reasonably well for a couple of years. They were making some really good progress. And then the school district made a leadership change at the school, sort of unannounced, without any consultation with Big Picture. So it threw that relationship into a little bit of a tailspin. And Big Picture decided that they were going to not partner with that district anymore. So when that happened, I started talking to the Seattle district and the Highline district about whether they wanted to consider starting a new high school. Mm-hmm. And didn't really get anywhere at all in Seattle. And Highline was just coming to terms with their cohort graduation data. Number or percentage of kids graduating based on who started in the ninth grade, and they were kind of on their heels realizing we got to do something different and we don't have all the answers. And so we came in at just the right time when they were sort of open to thinking about this new school. But generally, it's prior to the charter law, there hasn't really been a mechanism to say, hey, let's start this new school. So my sense is that in comparison to some other parts of the country, there's not a lot of diversity of how people do secondary school here.
There's not a lot of diversity of different kinds of schools?
I would say, yeah, relative to other places. I mean, I think in an effort to prevent the charter law from coming about here, it was a veiled attempt. Some would say it wasn't about that at all, but to some of us, it looked like a way to say, hey, we don't need a charter school in Washington because look at all the innovative schools we have. So the House passed this innovative schools bill that designated a bunch of schools in the state innovation schools. But the demographic collectively served by all those schools, not all that representative of the population in the state, I don't think. Certainly not a population you would deem as being you know, typically those most poorly served by public education. And
right.
the what passed for innovation in a lot of the schools was sort of on the level of a thematic approach. So some pretty interesting schools made that list, but for the most part,
Did you say thematic approach?
Yeah. So there are some different schools in our area from the standpoint of a theme, but what I mean by not a lot of diversity of approaches to how to do secondary is among those schools, the academics, if it's, say, at the high school level, the academic sequence would still, for the most part, occur in the same order. Teachers are identified by subject area. The way that students and teachers spend their time together is determined by teacher endorsement and the student's credit needs. Graduation is determined by the accumulation of a specific number and distribution of credits. So all that stuff, pretty much the same. In contrast, and all of the schools under leadership of public school districts. In contrast to some other places where you might find much more out-of-the-box approaches to project-based learning or block scheduling or not associating teachers with subject area in the same way, not necessarily graduating students by credits, and schools that are charters administered by districts or administered by universities or you know, a teacher-run co-op or just all sorts of different ways to conceive secondary. We've lacked that diversity here.
You've lost it, so you had it.
I'd say we've lacked it. And some people think the charter thing is going to change that. Part of the work that I've been doing more recently, which is what I alluded to in the email, is trying to establish a regional consortium to push innovative practice at the secondary level. And part of the incentive for that is feeling like the charter law here could have the effect of establishing or of bringing in models from other places that are focused on raising test scores. So not to say that there aren't good things about some of these schools, but just not contributing much to the idea that there are very different drivers that one might apply to running a middle school or a high school.
Okay, so like your school, for instance.
Yeah.
You don't have grades?
We don't have credits. So we got, and this was one of the things that is sort of unique about the school for a public school. We went through a process with the state board to get a waiver from the state-mandated graduation requirement. So that involved partnering with universities to kind of get their support and get their help in designing our transcript, and then first getting the approval of our local school board, because that's the way that you have to apply for the state board waiver as a district rather than as a single school. So we went through the district and then, with their support, applied to the Washington State Board of Education to graduate students based on something other than this distribution of credits.
And that worked. Amazingly.
It worked. Yeah. A little tenuously. In fact, the very first school in Washington, as far as I know, to get such a waiver was that one I mentioned that partnered with Big Picture in 2001 or so. Mm-hmm. When they got their waiver from the state, so their big fight was at a local level. They had a tough time getting their local school board to sign off on that. But once that happened, when they got to the state board, the state board said, oh, we're so excited someone's finally, you know, taking advantage of this piece of the law that's trying to encourage innovative approaches. And so they just sailed through at the state level. And then every year when they went back to kind of report to the state on how that was going, it was just this very non-rigorous show up and present with some students, and the state board members were always excited to interact with the students, but there was never any, it wasn't a very tough scrutiny to maintain the waiver. When we got ours in 2008, the accountability climate had changed enough that I think the conversation at the state level was more difficult. And then when we got it renewed, we're supposed to renew it every 5 years, I think. So we went through a renewal process in 2012-13 that I think further reflected this shift toward high-stakes testing accountability, which I find really troubling, and which the work I'm doing now is partly trying to kind of push back against.
Okay, so...
So one of the ways that we talk about that with the state board, and one of the ways that or a conversation that I think if you work at a school like the one where I've been working, you find yourself in, is people say, well, wait, you don't do grades and you don't have classes, so how do you know they're getting, how do you know that all kids are, you know, learning all this content that they would otherwise be learning? And the assumption is that in the more conventional approach of how many classes, 6 classes, you've often not very well connected to each other, and then students go experience that, and they get this grade, and they get a credit. So the assumption sometimes in that line of questioning is a kid who, you know, gets a C and acquires their 0.5 credit in such and such a topic has mastered some content of that topic. And part of our approach is that that approach to school does not work for a huge number of kids. But part of the difficulty of trying to implement something different is you're sometimes held to this standard as if the status quo was working really well. I don't know if that makes sense, but...
Are you saying that when... that in normal schools or traditional schools, when kids get a C, they don't necessarily have to have mastered any content to get that C?
Well, that was part of the data that we showed in our presentation to not do grades is some research on the disconnect between grades and mastery of skills associated with a particular course. So the number of the extent to which grading practice is sometimes based on attitude or things that are not necessarily connected to whether the student has acquired this particular skill
a student who just turns in all the work is liable to get a C, even if
sure.
they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. Right. So and the big picture approach. Generally, I would say prioritizes engagement, and the school where I've been working, or where I was working, increasingly is focused on metacognitive variables. I think the latest term for them that have been shown to correlate strongly with post-secondary success, like being persistent in college and having a stronger test score. So redesigning the way the school works in order to prioritize students being highly engaged, taking a lot of ownership for their learning, being self-directed, and developing these metacognitive attributes.
Right. So metacognitive attributes, that means, what does that mean again?
There are different lists of them. The ones that that big picture has been focused on mostly, I think, were first introduced by this researcher named William Sedlacek, and there just happens to be a list of 8 of them. The first one is positive self-concept. The next one is realistic self-appraisal, and I don't know the order after that, but it's things like ability to navigate a racist system or a system that wasn't necessarily designed with you in mind. Availability of a strong support person, leadership experience. So Sedlacek developed this list of attributes, and it wasn't so much saying that, hey, people ought to have these, so let's work toward them. It was looking at students who were being effective in, I think it was first research on graduate school, but it was looking at students who were already being effective and trying to understand what attributes do they possess. And then these have been used by the Gates Millennium Scholarships Program and an increasing number of colleges and universities as admission criteria, because they show stronger correlation in how kids are going to do than things like SAT scores. I believe for all subgroups except white males.
Well, that's interesting. But wait, so another word for metacognitive skills might then be like character?
Well, that's the interesting thing. Like in Sedlacek's initial work, he called them non-cognitive variables. But then there's a paper that came out, I think last summer, and it was a literature review on studies of non-cognitive factors, I think the word was that they used. And it grouped them into a bunch of subcategories, including things like perseverance, grit, academic mindset, social skills. So this big amalgam of things having to do with your ability to be effective as a learner and as a student.
What was that last thing you said?
A whole bunch of factors having to do with your just ability to be effective as a student. So this paper out of Chicago focus, I think it groups them into things like academic mindset. So it's trying to get at things like persistence. Oh, another one of the Sedlacek list is affinity for, I don't know if affinity is the word, but it's something like favoring long-term goals. So are you able to get your head around the idea that this might not be fun right now, but I want to accomplish this thing later, so I'm going to persist at this right now. So one of the things at Highline Big Picture we've been trying to do is, as we understand these, trying to figure out what about the way we're doing school is reinforcing which ones of these attributes, and then how do we increase those. And so that's sort of getting at what I was saying earlier about, for us, the driving priorities of making a great secondary school need to be about engagement. So instead of leading with something like the Common Core and saying, how do we design a school so that every kid hits these targets in a big list of standards, instead of saying that, how do we design a school so that students are really excited to be there, they're developing agency as learners, they're passionate about what they're doing, and they're developing the attributes that are going to serve them well post high school.
Is there something about you said other schools are just are going to be more geared towards high stakes testing? Is there something that's antithetical about that and to your approach?
Antithetical about high stakes testing to our approach,
to the metacognitive approach.
I don't know about I mean, I think you could still be. I think they could coexist, but one of the, this project that I've been working on for the last year or so around trying to improve the climate regionally for secondary innovations that support better outcomes for kids, particularly kids of color, low-income kids, the ones we tend to do worse by, mm-hmm. A huge barrier to that innovation is this kind of gridlock of compliance that we're in. So I don't think it's a bad thing if students do well on SATs or standardized tests, but what I experience happening now is there's the culture of accountability and compliance is such that that everything is driven by the test scores. And so it precludes being able to think more broadly about what is school for, how do we get students to own their own learning. And I also think it leads to a kind of teaching and learning that's pretty disconnected from what the needs of modern workplaces and modern problem solving are. I mean, when I talk to people who are wrestling with really compelling issues in their work lives, the kinds of work that they're doing, the kinds of learning that they're engaged in does not look anything like, you know, you show up and someone puts the learning target on the board and then you work largely in isolation to try to demonstrate that you've met that target. It just, I think that there's a huge disconnect.
Mm-hmm. So you're also having people work 2 days a week as interns, and I'm interested in how that's done.
Yeah, so the sort of classic big picture design is, one of the ways that the co-founders put it was, if we could forget that we've heard of this thing called school, we could forget everything we know about school and focus instead on learning, like how does really powerful learning happen, then what would the school look like that was supporting that? So some of the design priorities were, extended meaningful relationships between students and adults, enough space for a lot of informal learning to happen. As you're listening to this, what I hear are the ways that some of these paths to powerful learning have been like literally designed out of a lot of high schools. So extended meaningful adult relationships. So the big picture approach to that was to say, we'll have 15 students in a group. They'll start in the ninth grade with one teacher, and that teacher will follow that group of 15 for all 4 years. So it creates this intensely connected little family unit that's going to move through high school together. That teacher is going to get to know those kids really intimately, going to get to know their families really well. In contrast to that, typical large high school, a teacher might see, 120 kids a week. And if there's a lot of pressure to maximize instructional time, they see all those kids in large groups, and then there's a very constrained passing time. So any informal time between adults and kids is intentionally driven out of the schedule. So another component of the big picture design is that instead of sitting in school all day telling kids about things that they're going to need to know in order to do these cool jobs or pursue these really interesting fields later on, given that a lot of those things are happening in the community around the school, instead of just telling them what it's going to be like, why don't we let them get out and experience it? So that's the internship piece, and it has this whole other set of components. I think the biggest way to sum it up is to just call it real-world learning. So if students are immersed in the work of adults, then they're doing real stuff. And so it gets the school out of the role of contrivance.
Of what?
Of contrivance. So instead of telling a kid, hey, you should learn this because it's on the test, or you should learn this because it'll be really important to you later, and the accountability is going to be a system that we've devised to give you a grade. Instead of doing that, how about, okay, now you're part of this project at this workplace. It's meaningful to you because it's something you're interested in, and this workplace does real work, so it's consequential. And so the accountability is the same as it is for, for real people. Like in my own work, as a principal or other jobs I've had, the thing that drove me to, or the thing that drives me to do my best work is I think the outcomes are important to something that matters. And I'm also doing the work with other people. And so if I do a crummy job, then my colleagues or the people I'm working in this context with are going to be disappointed in me, and I'm not going to contribute to this outcome that I think is really important. And so part of the big picture approach is why do we need to withhold all that from kids? Why don't we find out what they're interested in and then a couple days a week put them among adults doing that thing, and then they can have the same things motivate their great work that motivate most people's great work. And it also sets the stage for a ton of informal learning. Like if a student's around a bunch of adults doing something that they think is cool, conversations are going to come up like, how did you get to do this? And then it helps the student internalize, if I think I want to be doing anything like what these people are doing, I should clue into how they got where they are and start doing some backwards planning. I contrast that with a student who's not very engaged in a large, traditionally structured high school, who's, if they don't play a sport or play an instrument or get in trouble a lot or do something else that's going to put them in the company of the same adults over and over, chances are they don't feel a strong connection to any adult in the school. They're not known well by any adult in the school. Their exposure to careers is limited to the adults that they know, which, for more affluent kids, that might be a broad range. For kids who don't have a lot of exposure to adults in a diversity of careers, then their sense of what they might want to do is probably limited to media or things that they've heard about, maybe not having a very accurate sense of what it might be like to do those things. So what those schools offer sometimes is like an online career search thing where you enter information about yourself and the system lets you know that you might like some of these careers. But in comparison to actually getting out and job shadowing and spending a couple days a week being among people doing all these things, which seems really inadequate.
So what are the outcomes? The kids, are they able to do okay on tests now?
Depending on the test and depending on the student. Yeah, at Highline Big Picture, it's been sort of an arc. Like, for a number of years, consistently we've done quite well on the reading and writing tests that our district sort of runs, or I guess those are state tests, the state reading and writing tests. And in the early years of the school, the math test was more kind of problem-solving oriented, and then in the last few years they've shifted to end-of-course exams that correspond to specific content in algebra and geometry. And we've done less well on those, but that's shifting upward or, positively trending.
Mm-hmm. So I guess really you're aiming, though, for a kind of success that may not be measured on these tests, which is, life success, which
Well, I think we're aiming for the same thing that other schools are aiming for. I think we're trying to aim at it very directly. So if I understand what other schools are trying to do, it's prepare kids to be successful after high school in higher education and careers that support them and are meaningful to them. I think where we've gotten stuck as a system is using high-stakes testing and focusing on the wrong things as proxies for that. So if we can raise these test scores in these certain courses, that will help kids get the courses they need to then be prepared with a transcript to get into college. And for us, it's more about what are the attributes of effective adults and effective learners. Let's aim at those three rather than using a bunch of proxies.
Okay, well, so what do you think the future of schools is going to be like? I mean, there's a lot of innovations, a lot of innovative schools. Is there going to be one model and one collection of innovations that is eventually going to just be in every school, or are we going to end up with a bunch of different models?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. It's really an interesting time. Like, I think in the last handful of years, we've gone backwards with the accountability piece. So there seems like
The what piece?
The accountability piece. Like, I think kind of freaking out that kids aren't achieving. So let's raise the stakes on teachers and schools with more testing. But I think I see that driving things way more than I did 5 or 6 years ago in a way that I find really discouraging. But on the flip side, I see increasing examples of backlash against that, and some positive developments around, the blended learning thing is tricky. With technology allows certain kinds of differentiation that we couldn't do a while ago, which could be a really good thing, but is not as simple as just connecting kids with online platforms and cutting out the teacher. So, where is it going? I don't know, but it's kind of an exciting time. I think the model that high school is to prepare you to do college in this particular way, and then if you do college in this particular way, you're all set, has been dealt a big setback by, I think, the economic crisis and student debt issues. So just around the time that we started Big Picture, I think I was thinking the ideal outcome is we need to get everybody into a four-year college. And in the relatively short time since then, I feel like we started seeing a lot of cases where it made much more economic sense for a student to pursue another pathway toward a college degree. And I started to see college as, in a lot of cases, an extension of the same problem that I think too many high schools are stuck in. Let's go sit still and do a not very exciting form of teaching and learning, or teaching and not learning, and accumulate credits with the result that we're, you know, not really any smarter. We don't know how to do anything that we didn't know how to do before. So kind of questioning, like, what's the value add of college? And I think a bunch of changes that are afoot are continuing to push that. Like, if I had a teenager right now, instead of thinking, as I might have been thinking, like, I do well in high school and then go to a four-year college, I I think I would be thinking, what's the most compelling thing they can do for their future? And there might be a handful of colleges that would serve that, and there might be a bunch of other things that they could do that would serve it better.
Like what would be an example? Can you give an example?
Like a series of internships, or like jump right into some work situation.
Mm-hmm. Do they get to do when they get a job? I mean, if that job doesn't, does every job have an opportunity to do the classic academic subjects? Through that job,
every job, or, every internship, you mean?
Yeah, every internship.
No, and I think that's part of the way that we're challenging the prevailing view about what high school is supposed to be about. So an interesting exercise we've done in some presentations has been to take that list of 8 non-cognitive attributes that I mentioned earlier and intersperse them with common core standards. And I don't know if you've ever seen that activity called crossing the line, where it's often done in like a cultural competency training or something about interacting with groups around race or sexual orientation.
It was in that Freedom Riders movie.
Okay, yeah, so you say, like, cross the line if. And so we've done an activity where we've, like, the prompt would be cross the line if you have a strong support person that you rely on in a crisis or that you go to for advice. So we interspersed the non-cognitive attributes with certain common core examples, like I was a high school science teacher. So cross the line if you can describe the process by which a gene is translated into a protein and what's the significance of this for the process of natural selection. Like, if I'm a science teacher and I'm a science guy in high school, it doesn't get much more kind of essential than that. Like, if you can't explain that, then you're sort of at a loss for this, you know, fundamental concept of biology. So take the equivalent of that for, math, U.S. history, English language arts, chemistry, physics. So we would be in these large rooms of, I think the first time we did this, it was with admissions directors from four-year colleges, and then we did it as a presentation to school board members from around the state, and then some of my colleagues have done it in other audiences. But the assumption is that most everybody in the room is a reasonably successful adult, and what we find is that almost no one crosses the line to sort of step up and say, yeah, I can back up right now that I'm solid on that common core standard. But almost everyone usually crosses the line for the non-cognitive stuff. And so part of the point or the question we're trying to raise is, if the attributes of effective adults is this stuff, then why are we designing schools that focus exclusively on this other stuff that, unless you're in a particular field, you either never got in the first place or you got it for a little while and then you lost track of it.
Right.
So it's not saying deep content knowledge is not important. In fact, it's saying the opposite. And it's saying that, you know, what drives powerful learning is getting excited about something and then going super deep with it. And what really kills it is trying to say that everything is equally important. And so I'm going to make you learn just a little bit about so much stuff that the message is going to be almost everything is boring. And if I don't understand it, the response is punitive and so on. So it's sort of, it's not being dismissive of the common core as much as it's being very concerned about how it's used. So to your question, like, not every internship would lend itself well to exploring all the disciplines equally, and that we would say is a good thing. Like if you're focusing on this project, let the project dictate what the learning is.
But does there have to be something that is connected to certain standards that person has to show that they've mastered through that job?
Not necessarily directly connected to the internship, but at Big Picture, students do exhibitions and present portfolios a handful of times a year, and that's when they talk about, based on all the stuff I did, this was my internship, this was the other project I did, this was this workshop I took. Based on all that, let me talk for a while about what I've learned and how that relates to my overall progress toward what I want to do in life. And in our state waiver, we kind of gave a nod to the standards in saying that these are the bodies of competencies that the work will be about, and this is how that relates to the standards. But we also tried to be pretty intentional in saying that one of the issues we have with the way standards are currently implemented, or at least at the time were currently implemented, is that it made everything equal. So there's this huge, huge list of state standards, and there was no allowance for these certain ones are really critical. Like if you don't have these three or four attributes and capabilities, you're really going to struggle. Whereas these other ones are more deeper into layers of content. Instead of that, it was just like, here they all are, and we got to hit them all. The credit distribution that the state requires, and this is probably similar in most states, it's something like 4 language arts, 3 math, 2 or 3 history, 1 a U.S. history, 1 credit of art. And if you just kind of read that, it's like, yeah, cool, that makes sense. It's going to be taking English every time, and you got to get some electives in there. But on the other hand, it's sort of saying, language arts is more important than mathematics or numeracy by a ratio of 4 to 3. Math is more important than art by a ratio of 3 to 1. Like if you kind of unpack those numbers, it's making a statement that what everyone needs is this precise recipe of content distribution. When that's just like so unreal in comparison to what life is like and what people are like, and so
yeah, like you should, like every person should be 4 parts language arts, 3 parts math, 1 part art.
Yeah, so I think a misinterpretation of when we talk about this, sometimes people are like, oh, so you think not every kid should have to take science, and it's almost saying the opposite, because I love science. It's saying, I think if we approach science in the prevailing way that we do, we kill a ton of kids' interest in science, because what we communicate is some of you are good at it, some of you aren't. And I think we do it in a way that tries to cover a bunch of stuff at the expense of having it be really interesting. And I think if we prioritized engagement and having the learning be very real, instead of the fear that everyone would opt out of science, I think a lot more people would opt into science and say, like, wow, this is really interesting. Can I study this more?
So the 3 days that you have class, is there a difference in those classes of how the material's taught?
There aren't classes. So, our approach is that each student has a learning plan, and it's sort of populated by a mix of what is that student most excited about learning, what do they think they might want to be or do, or what are they most excited to learn, and then what are their current skills and what are the things that they need to get better at, what's the parent input, what's the advisor's input. So all these things are kind of lumped together. to develop a set of goals, and then that leads to an array of project work. So in the early grades, like ninth grade, there's going to be more group work and teacher-led work. So if you're an advisor and you're building a learning plan with a ninth grade student, you might say, okay, well, you know, we're all going to work on this, and then we're all going to be, you know, in this discussion 3 days a week, and we're all going to do this other thing together, and then you're also going to need to do an individual project, so what would you like to do with that? Whereas when students are older and they're directing their learning more, there'd probably be a lot more diversity of learning plans across the advisory. And then Monday, Wednesday, Friday, again, at the ninth grade level, it would probably be tipped a little bit more toward group work and structured work and a little bit less independent work time, but still a pretty good chunk of independent work time. And then as students are older, larger percentages of time when they're pursuing the work on their learning plans. And sometimes that involves taking community college courses or coursework at the nearby skills center, which does a lot of occupational stuff, and then the rest of it is a mix of individual and small group work that's driven by their learning plan.
So what does this look like if somebody were to walk into one of the rooms? You have rooms.
Yes, we do have rooms. It would look pretty different. Like, I was there this morning walking around trying to get some students together to help with this project at another school. And you know, when I walk by one room, they're all sitting around in a circle having a discussion about something. Like, I have no idea, because I didn't walk in, whether they were ninth graders. So I don't know if they're all reading the same book and they're discussing it, or I don't know if they're having a Socratic seminar about some piece of text they just read, or whether they're sitting around talking about what their various internship plans are for the week. And then in another room, you know, a few kids were at computers, a couple other kids were meeting about something, a couple other kids were talking to the advisor. And, yeah, so it looks different depending on what's going on. It definitely does, you know, there aren't, I mean, lunch happens at a certain time, but there's not a bell structure, so it's not the place that you can visit and say, okay, it's first period, so this is what we're likely to see.
Oh, that's very interesting.
There are some around you. There are, I mean, across the network, the design is interpreted different ways. I think we're pretty far along the continuum of having it be more project-based, more driven by the students' learning plans. And some other big picture schools, because of external constraints, they've implemented more classes. So, like, if you were to visit Big Picture San Diego or MetWest in Oakland or Met Sacramento in Sacramento, you would, and then came to Highline, you know, you could kind of put the four schools along a continuum of more or less structured.
Oh, you think really they represent all the different points?
Oh, I don't know if those represent all the points, but I think San Diego is probably the most structured of those, and we're probably the least. And but I don't know if we're – San Diego is probably not at the outside end of structure. Like, I think some of the schools that have come up in places where there's been less district support have – well, like, so there's a Bellevue across the water from us has a big picture school that just opened a couple years ago. And I think they may do, I don't know if they do classes every day, but like at the school in Highline, we try to have internships drive as much of the learning as we can. Whereas in Bellevue, I think it's much more of a something else that they do in addition to the classes.
Okay, but they still have internships. Is that the key to all the big picture school?
That's a good question. But on their website, I think they have a bunch of, they call them distinguishers. So depending on who you talk to, people might say, you know, if they had to pick one thing, you'd probably get some different things. I think that's the strongest one for me, is having the learning be real. So the way that we try to implement that is through internships. I think there are other ways, like a student could be doing an independent project. And if it's something that, you know, real adults would take on, and the student's collaborating with experts, then if it's not an internship per se, like where they go to a specific workplace, I think that can still be really powerful. So for me, the ultimate distinguisher is how real is the work and how connected is it to what that student's passionate about. Someone else might say it's knowing kids really well. Someone else might say it's connecting what they're doing to some really compelling post-high school plan. I mean, I think they're all interrelated.
So, but what they really have in common is these metacognitive focus.
That's actually, I think, been pushed more strongly at Highline. We learned about it from the network, but a few people at Highline really latched onto it. So that's probably driving more of the work at our school than at most big picture schools, although it hopefully is showing up to some degree in all of them. But at Highline, we really started changing things around directly in response to what we were learning about those. Like, for example, when we started the middle school a few years ago, their day was going to be way more structured than the high school day. Like, you can't, I don't think, take a bunch of middle schoolers and sort of free them up to do independent work time. So given that they seem to need a lot more structure, we set up more of a block schedule where it's like language arts and social studies part of the day, and then there was going to be a math science part of the day, a field trip every week to go explore some different thing going on in the community. But then I think the folks designing it were thinking, we've got to add in some electives, because otherwise this is too class-driven. So they came up with this elective block, and they said, we'll open it to parents or high school kids or any outside community partners, anyone who wants to lead an elective about anything that's of interest to them, that's the way that'll work. So a bunch of high school kids ended up teaching electives or leading electives that the middle school students were in. And prior to that happening, internships seemed like the highest leverage thing we were doing toward these metacognitives or non-cognitive variables. And once this elective thing started, we started realizing that leading an elective was also a really, really strong metacognitive factor for a lot of our high school kids. And part of the way this came out was we had a staff person doing research on the non-cognitive. So she was attending student exhibitions and tracking, like, if she thought she was hearing the student talk about developing a more realistic self-appraisal or having a leadership experience or talking about learning to focus on long-term goals instead of just short-term gratification, she would note what they were talking about. Like, were they talking about their internship or were they talking about this independent project? And electives started showing up really strongly as a huge new part of the program for high school kids. So then we expanded the elective program to high school, and a lot of how the elective program has evolved has been based on what we think we're learning about it in terms of the metacognitive. And I don't know the extent to which other schools are driving programs based on them as much, but that might just be what I don't know. I'm just less aware of what else that's going on in the network.
You don't know how the elective programs are going or how much of a part of the programs?
I don't know that they have them. Yeah.
but you have them in addition to internships. Wait, is that the same as internships or different electives?
No, it's different. It's different. They happen for the most part at school, and it's just kids
and
leading.
So you actually bring people in, and you're doing what you're describing at your school.
Yeah, they're a mix of, they really are an eclectic mix of things. Like the special education teacher named Phil led a skateboarding one, I think. The office manager led one that had something to do with like setting up an aquarium in the main office. So sometimes they're just these one-off project things. And then for quite some time, a group of high school kids led a drama elective. So it's just this really eclectic mix of things. I think there's a Minecraft elective, a video game.
I guess what I'm thinking when I'm hearing this is about how I know that when I'm trying to do something with a goal in mind that I'm excited about, I'm much more able to understand the information that's involved and, that I have to research, and I'm better at learning. And I guess that's what it comes down to is motive is, if people have something that's fun to do, then they're going to do what it takes to make it happen.
I mean, I think in some ways that's the gist. Like we could oversimplify it as that when schools neglect the engagement piece, there's just some degree of wheel spinning. Like if I'm an incredible teacher and I decide that I'm going to teach you how to do this thing that I'm really good at teaching, if I just bump into you on the street and say, Nick, now you're going to learn this. If there's no investment or intrinsic engagement on your part, even if I'm a pretty great teacher, that's going to be kind of an uphill battle, I think. Whereas,
well, yeah, Well, I was going to say that a really great teacher is probably somebody who manages to get a person to have that kind of engagement.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, but part of what Big Picture's approach is saying is unless it's been beaten out of them, like most people are really engaged in something. Everybody's
right.
Interested in something.
Right.
So it's not about let's keep them limited and say, that one thing you're interested in, that's all you have to think about. But how do we leverage that to expose them to other things? How do we leverage that to help them learn other things rather than what too many schools do, which is not even ask, or if it comes up, say, we're not talking about that now. So your interest in skateboarding or your interest in, I'm just thinking of a couple of students at Big Picture, your interest in military history has no place in this thing that we're talking about right now. So keep it to yourself. So it's trying to capitalize on that idea that when you're excited about something, I can't keep you from learning it, even if I wanted to. So if I can, tap into student excitement, then the teaching is going to be it's going to be empowered.
I mean, as you're saying that, I'm just thinking of specific students that I've had that had very clear interests that I just remember thinking, they are interested and good at something, and I wish they could be interested in what we're doing, but to take advantage of that would be great.
Well, and another way that Big Picture gets misinterpreted sometimes is that it's pushing kids to define your career really early. So, and instead of that, it's trying to say, hey, if you think you know what you want to do now, great, let's build on that. And if you don't, then rather than sit around at school and try to figure it out, let's support your getting out in the world to immerse yourself in different settings and see what you start to get excited about. And so on the Tuesdays and Thursdays, the teachers are supporting that process?
Okay, so yeah, when the students are interning, the teachers are doing what?
They're supporting that. So, like, this time of the year, what is it, October? So you probably have a handful of kids who are already in and out of the building doing job shadows. You probably have some, like when I was there today, I ran into a student who already has an internship. So if I'm an advisor and I have, like, 16, 17 kids, a handful of them already have an internship, and then others don't. So I probably am coordinating with my adult colleagues to make sure that enough of us are back at the building to support the kids who are still working from there to get out. And then others of us are freed up to drive around and meet with people that are kids or job shadowing. So it's a mix of you're out part of those days and the back at school helping kids get out on the other part of those days. And then ideal scenario, some little ways into the school year, all your kids have internships, and so then you're able to spend a larger percentage of your Tuesdays and Thursdays out doing that and doing whatever you might need to do by way of prep, because there's no
right.
Since there are no classes, there are no prep periods. So Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays tend to be, you know, pretty much full on.
You know, I'm thinking as we're saying this, where you have areas where you have certain industries are really predominant, could you maybe have, you know, whole themes, like schools like in, you know, Burbank, you have four different movie and TV studios, like ABC and Disney and Warner Brothers and whatever else.
Yeah.
You could have a whole school just dedicated to that industry, or even in some areas one company could power a school.
Yeah, you could totally do that. I think one of my hesitations would be not wanting the school to limit what a kid might discover, with the kind of the idea that you think you might want to go into film and then you may realize that something else excites you a lot more. So does that mean you got to, you know, go to a different school? Or could I think that would work really well if the school could be flexible enough to say, we're going to explore all sorts of things through the lens of the film industry or the whatever the industry was.
Like all the different jobs.
I mean, it's pretty common. I think this is one of the things that I think is exciting about the model. It's pretty common that a kid thinks, yeah, I really want to do this. And you say, oh, cool, how long have you wanted to do that? It's like, oh, just, you know, as long as I can remember, I've always wanted to be a so-and-so, I've always wanted to do this. And then when they go experience what that's like by interning or job shadowing, they sometimes discover that it wasn't at all what they thought it was.
Right.
And in the process, they discover some other interest that heads them off in different directions.
Mm-hmm. Imagine if, like you just had a company, like, could you have, like, I'm just thinking of different, if I was going to school now, if I would, you know, go to a school that was like the journalism school, and it would, you know, you would have all these channels to different media outlets and,
mm-hmm.
That kind of magnet. Well, do you find yourself having all, like, branching out into all kinds of wild ideas? When you start from just ways of using your model and just expanding on it?
You mean to start other kinds of schools, or?
Yeah, ways to spread it and just get different, just use it in different ways, the model?
Well, I've had some friends who've used it to get jobs, like using the big picture approach of, calling people who do the thing that they want to do and asking if they can job shadow. And then asking if they could intern for free, and then that segueing into some career change or job. But the thing I'm working on now is trying to use what we learned at Big Picture to inform work in other schools in the region. So just trying to develop this regional network of schools talking about how to be more engaging, how to be more real, and how to better accomplish the metacognitives for larger numbers of students.
Well, sounds great, Jeff. Thank you so much for taking this time to talk to me. Is it part of your sense of mission to do this?
It's fun. I like talking about it. I sense of mission maybe at a that sounds, I don't know, too important or something. It's a really fun topic for me. So it'd be fun to talk about it more if other questions come up or interact on email about visit opportunities or whatever would keep the conversation going.
You know, I am going to school for my educational administration credential, and I do have to job shadow, so I would be interested in that. Job shadowing you.
Fun.
If you don't mind. All right, well, thanks, Jeff, for talking today. That was great.
Yeah. Thank you, Nick.
All right.
So this other, just one other idea.